close my eyes. To everything that's gay, if you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes? My heart.
It's appalling. That's my reaction to a system that requires customers to buy groceries by running their finger over a scanner. Fingerprint shopping is being tested at grocery stores across the country. In a program system, your fingerprint is linked to your credit card or bank account. At best, fingerprint matching is only 80% accurate, and all technology can be compromised. Who takes the print to set up your account? A checker trained in biometrics? Hardly. Where are the laws that define the purchase, sale, or transfer of these unique parts of your body to others? And where's the time-saving factor? You still have to key in a code, sign a receipt, and say paper or plastic. I'm Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. To learn more about this issue and other privacy issues, join us on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Jeanette Walls. Jeanette Walls is author of the best-selling memoir, The Glass Castle, published by Scribner. She is also a reporter for MSNBC.com. She's written for New York, Esquire, USA Today. Her book, The Glass Castle, has been a New York Times bestseller for, is it 50 weeks at this point? We'll let her tell us. And what a great book. We're here to talk to her about it today. Let's bring her on. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi.
Great to have you on.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Your book is quite amazing. I have so much I want to talk to you about regarding it. But
bless your heart. Thank you.
Let's start with just, you know, you telling us really how the book came about and how you knew you wanted to do a memoir.
Well, you know, it's something I'd wanted to do for years, but at the same time, I really resisted it. I was, quite frankly, ashamed of my past. And honestly, there was no doubt in my mind that if I really told everybody the truth about myself, that I was going to lose my job, and I was going to lose my friends, and I was going to lose whatever meager little standing I have in this world. And I was just terrified of it. But I felt that I had to write something. And I sat down a couple of times in my 20s and again in my 30s and just tried to write something. And I'd write a couple of hundred pages, and then I'd throw it all away. And honestly, it was my husband who pretty much duct-taped me to the desk. He's also a writer. And he said, you know, I'd known him for years, and I'd never really told him anything about my past. And finally, we were just friends at this point, but he threatened to stop being friends with me if I wouldn't tell him anything about my past, because he thought, you know, any real friendship is about honesty. And I didn't want to let him know, because I was ashamed. And when I did finally, when he wormed it out of me, his first reaction was, that would make a great book. So he really did, he really pulled it out of me.
So then how did it begin? You wrote a draft?
He hooked up with our agent. We have this same agent. And she said, yeah, you know, John said, oh, Jeanette's got a great story. His name is John Taylor. So Jeanette's got a great story. And my agent said, yeah, her and everybody else. Go ahead and tell her to write something, but don't get her hopes up. But they set a deadline for me, and I have many faults, but one of them is not, I do not miss a deadline. So I went ahead and cranked something out, and I wrote the first draft from beginning to end in 6 weeks. And the truth, it was absolutely terrible. It was just awful. But I showed it to my agent, and she said what I'd done is I'd written it as a reporter. I'd written it as though it happened to somebody else. It wasn't stream of consciousness, you know, raw emotion bad. It was just, it was very removed. And my default mode is that I write in bad journalese and use words that people never say in real conversation, like heretofore and things like that. And she kept on saying that I had to write what it felt like and how it affected me, and I kept on insisting it didn't affect me. I'm perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of this conversation, when she was recounting some of the things that I'd written about, she said, oh, Jeanette, come on. You were writing about falling out of a car and nobody noticed, and you were talking about being thrown in the back of a U-Haul. This stuff had to have affected you. And I said, no, I'm perfectly fine. And in the middle of this conversation, I burst into tears, and I'm not a crier. So I guess it drove home to me that the point that I was holding stuff back, and I was sort of in denial about how I felt about the whole thing. So I sat down and I wrote, I try to write it from the perspective of a child to get at those emotions rather than writing it as an adult looking back on what it felt like to go through all of these episodes and this drama. And what we did is I wrote about 60 pages in the voice that I was hoping to, you know, to write the rest of the book in, and my agent shopped around based on that.
Wow. And of course, it was most likely snapped up right away.
I don't know. It was bought pretty quickly, but I don't know how many people she showed it to. One of the great things about having an agent is you don't have to have all those painful discussions about, well, we like you, but... Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So I don't know how many people it was shown to. It was bought by Scribner, a wonderful editor named Graham, and I have absolutely nothing but praise for both my agent and my editor. I thought that they were both quite wonderful. But they gave me a pretty liberal deadline on writing the book, and it took me another 5 years to complete it with the editing process and everything. It took me 5 years from beginning to end to write the thing.
Hmm.
But that is also while I had a day job. So it was mostly, my day job is 4 days a week, and so I spent 3 days a week writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for that 5 years, I didn't have a single day of vacation or a single day off. But it was, you know, it was an incredible experience. I really, you know, that sounds very cliched, but I think that memoir writing is all about being honest. And in writing a memoir, I was forced to be honest about things that I don't think I'd really been honest about before. You know, how did I really feel about these things? You really have to try to answer that, and it's not always easy. But I think that you know things you don't realize that you know. And in confronting these things, you have to be honest with yourself as well as your readers.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Jeanette Walls, author of The Glass Castle, and published by Scribner. So in recreating the past, how do you do that with, say, dialogue, when most likely when you're living through it, you're not also keeping a journal and writing down what everybody said.
Oh, yeah, took no journals, took no notes. You know, and it's interesting, I actually did grapple with, well, direct dialogue. Should I put it in italics or something to indicate that this is obviously not a direct quote? And I tried that, and I just didn't like the way it ran. I found it difficult. But honestly, Barbara, I would not have included something in quotes unless I could remember in my mind it being said. Now, that being said, I'm certain that I got, you know, of course, I didn't have a tape recorder. I'm sure I got things wrong. But it's as when you sit, you know, it's like when you sit down with some friends and you say, and then Mom told me, get your butt out of here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you remember your mother saying that. Were those her exact words? You know, I think that the conceit you have to make to memoirs is it's to the best of your memory. And so I would not have included dialogue unless I remember the conversation that way. Is it 100% accurate? I'm certain that it's not. But, you know, some people have questioned because the memoir opens when I'm, my earliest memory is when I'm 3 years old. And what happened is I caught on fire while I was cooking hot dogs for myself. And I remember the scene very, very vividly. In fact, when I was about to write it, my husband, he advised me, he said, you know, Jeanette, this scene is going to depend on details. So put in as much detail as you can possibly remember. So I, oh, okay. And I go back and I wrote it, and I showed it to him, and he said, he read it, and he goes, you can take out some of this detail. Because I just remember the scene so vividly. I remember the smells. I remember not just the voices, but specific things that were said to me. And I've talked to a number of people since my book has come out about the whole issue of memory. And apparently, it's an interesting thing. Apparently, traumatic memories are stored in a certain part of the brain where they have better recall. So, you know, the fact that I was burned, it was very easily accessible. And I've talked to a number of readers and other writers who say that they very vividly remember things that happened to them when they were three. And they can retell the dialogue and the color of the clothes that people were wearing. So what I did is I sat down and I wrote the most vivid scenes first, such as getting burned and being thrown in this big hot water geyser when my father was trying to teach us to swim and things like that. So I wrote down the most memorable scenes, and then I tried to sort of write what was in between. And I think that most people would be surprised. Many people have said, how could you possibly remember all of these things? Well, the most vivid scenes I had little trouble remembering. Where I actually had a lot more trouble was trying to put them all in sequence. Well, what happened next? I can remember the individual events, but where did this happen? Were we living in Battle Mountain at the time, or were we living in Midland, and what happened in between? And so that was the greater challenge. But it's an interesting thing with memory. I believe that people remember much more than they realize that they remember. You know, that's what hypnosis is all about, is unlocking those memories. So that's one of the things that it took me 5 years to do, was to try to really remember. Now, I also, my brother is, he's just got this incredibly keen memory. So I was able to show him the chapters as soon as I would finish them, or the sections as soon as I would finish them, when I'd bounce things off him. And I was incredibly encouraged that his memory of things was almost identical to mine.
Mm.
Though it's funny, he has a very different take on things, you know,
mm-hmm.
A different interpretation of events. But his recall of the events was very similar.
And in terms of the structure of the book, beginning when you're three, mm-hmm. how did you think about the structure? Did you write the book in a linear way, or did you start writing about events that were right there on the tip of your mind and go back and bring in others?
Yeah, I wrote it in a pretty linear way. For some reason, I always knew that I would open up with a scene seeing my mother when I was an adult, because that is one of the things that really did push me to writing it, was confronting my past,
mm-hmm.
quite literally, and having my mother challenge me to tell the truth. So that really was something that made me realize I really have to tell this story. But then after that, it was quite linear, though. I did write the most memorable scenes first, in a fairly linear way. And then go back and just write it and rewrite it and rewrite it. I've talked to some people who've written memoirs, and they write a couple of pages or maybe even just a paragraph or two a day, but they're perfectly constructed, and I don't write that way. I'm a sloppy writer. I'm a fast, sloppy writer. So I got it all down, and then I would just go back and try to rework it and rework it. And there are certain scenes I wrote 20 or 30 times trying to get it right. Like, how, just really be honest with myself. What really happened? How did it feel? And because I wrote it in the voice of a child, you know, it had to be not just in the voice, but also the psychology, and trying to remember how did I feel about this?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, will you read to us?
I beg your pardon?
Will you read to us?
Was I into it?
No, will you read to us? Read from your book?
Oh, of course. I'm so sorry. No, I blocked that out. Yes, I'll read the opening section, actually.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and Jeanette Walls is about to read from The Glass Castle.
I was sitting in a taxi, wondering if I had overdressed for the evening, when I looked out the window and saw Mom rooting through a dumpster. It was just after dark. A blustery March wind whipped the steam coming out of the manholes, and people hurried along the sidewalks with their collars turned up. I was stuck in traffic 2 blocks from the party where I was heading. Mom stood 15 feet away. She had tied rags around her shoulders to keep the cold spring chill wind out and was picking through the trash while her dog, a black and white terrier mix, played at her feet. Mom's gestures were all familiar, the way she tilted her head and thrust out her lower lip when studying items of potential value that she'd hoisted out of the dumpster, the way her eyes widened with childish glee when she found something she liked. Her long hair was streaked with gray, tangled and matted, and her eyes had sunk deep into their sockets. But still she reminded me of the mom she'd been when I was a kid, swan diving off cliffs and painting in the desert and reading Shakespeare aloud. Her cheekbones were still high and strong, but the skin was parched and ruddy from all those winters and summers exposed to the elements. To the people walking by, she probably looked like any of the thousands of homeless people in New York City. It had been months since I laid eyes on Mom, and when she looked up, I was overcome with panic that she'd see me and call out my name, and that someone on their way to the party would spot us together, and Mom would introduce herself, and my secret would be out. I slid down in the seat and asked the driver to turn around to take me home to Park Avenue. The taxi pulled up in front of my building, and the doorman held the door for me. The elevator man took me to my floor. My husband was working late, as he did most nights, and the apartment was silent, except for the click of my heels on the polished wood floor. I was still rattled from seeing Mom, the unexpectedness of coming across her, the sight of her rooting happily through the dumpster. I put some Vivaldi on, hoping the music would settle me down. I looked around the room. There were turn-of-the-century bronze and silver vases and old books and worn leather spines that I'd collected at flea markets. There were Georgian maps I'd framed, the Persian rugs, and the overstuffed leather armchair I liked to sink into at the end of the day. I tried to make a home for myself here, tried to turn the apartment into the sort of place where the person I wanted to be would live. But I could never enjoy the room without worrying about Mom and Dad, huddled on a sidewalk grate somewhere. I fretted about them, but I was embarrassed by them, too, and ashamed of myself for wearing pearls and living on Park Avenue while my parents were busy keeping warm and trying to find a place to eat. What could I do? I tried to help them countless times, but Dad would insist they didn't need anything, and Mom would ask for something silly, like a perfume atomizer or a membership at a health club. They said they were living the way they wanted to. After ducking down in the taxi so Mom couldn't see me, I hated myself. I hated my antiques, my clothes, and my apartment. I had to do something, so I called a friend of Mom's and left a message. It was our system of staying in touch. It always took Mom a few days to get back to me, but when I heard from her, she sounded, as always, cheerful and casual, as though we just had lunch the day before. I told her I wanted to see her and suggested she drop by the apartment, but she wanted to go to a restaurant. She loved eating out, so we agreed to meet for lunch at her favorite Chinese restaurant. Mom was sitting at a booth studying the menu when I arrived. She'd made an effort to fix herself up. She wore a bulky gray sweater with only a few light stains and black men's leather shoes. She'd washed her face, but her neck and temples were still dark with grime. She waved enthusiastically when she saw me. "It's my baby girl," she called out. I kissed her cheek. Mom had dumped all the plastic packets of soy sauce and duck sauce and hot and spicy mustard from the table into her purse. Now she emptied a wooden bowl of dried noodles into it as well. "A little snack for later on," she explained. Mom chose Seafood Delight. "You know how much I love my seafood," she said. She started talking about Picasso. She'd seen a retrospective of his and decided that his work was hugely overrated. All that Cuba stuff was gimmicky as far as she was concerned. He hadn't really done anything worthwhile after his Rose period. "I'm worried about you," I tell her. "Tell me what I can do to help." Her smile faded. "What makes you think I need your help?" "I'm not rich," I said, "but I have some money. Tell me what it is you need." She thought for a moment. "I could use an electrolysis treatment." "Be serious." "I am serious. If a woman looks good, she feels good." "Come on, Mom. I felt my shoulders tightening up the way they invariably did during these conversations. I'm talking about something that could help you change your life. Make it better. You want to help me change my life? Mom asked. I'm fine. You're the one who needs help. Your values are all confused. Mom, I saw you picking through the trash in the East Village a few days ago. Well, people in this country are too wasteful. It's my way of recycling. She took a bite of her seafood delight. Why didn't you say hello? I was too ashamed, Mom. I hid. Mom pointed her chopsticks at me. You see, she said, right there, that's exactly what I'm saying. You're way too easily embarrassed. Your father and I are who we are. Accept it. And what am I supposed to tell people about my parents? Just tell the truth, Mom said. That's simple enough.
Thank you so much. That was Jeanette Walls reading from the intro to The Glass Castle, published by Scribner. I'll tell you. And so you did. You did tell the truth.
Well, yes, it's probably the best advice anybody has ever given me. Just tell the truth. And, you know, I am a big believer in this point that the truth will set you free. And it's ironic because, you know, it's something that I, in my career, I'm supposed to be doing with, you know, with everything. And, you know, you might call it ironic, you might call it hypocritical, but that I hadn't turned the microscope on myself. You know, it's, you know, shame on me, but I now believe more than ever that the truth will set you free. But I also see how incredibly powerful the truth is. And, you know, there are the facts and there's the truth, and it's not always the easiest thing to get at. You know, in writing about my life, you know, first of all, the book covers most of the action is in the first 17 years of my life. But you still have to pick and choose the anecdotes that you choose to share, and by that you are shaping the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so how can you be honest and fair and thorough? And how much do you want to leave out bad stuff? How much bad stuff do you include? It's a very, very tough and fascinating process.
So how did that work for you in terms of, well, one thing you were worried about before the book came out was, as you said, what people would think once they learned the truth.
Well, I just figured, what the hell, I'm committing social suicide. Just take the plunge, just do it. And I had to tell myself on a couple of occasions, just tell yourself nobody's going to read it, which on some level I did believe. I did not think that this would become anywhere, you know, that it would not get the readership that it did. I thought that maybe I'd get a couple of reviews, but the truth would be out there and I'd have to deal with it. But I was tired, to be honest. I was tired of hiding from the truth. I just felt like it's time to come clean. Just go for it. You know, and I think that I had reached a point in my life. You know, I'm 46 now, and I did have a career, and I felt, okay, you've done it. You've been there. You've had what you set out to do. You can let it all go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the fact that my husband was so encouraging. You know, he comes from a very lovely background, and that he could accept it was a huge breakthrough for me. But I think that you do have to sort of just pretend, you know, if any of your listeners are out there trying to deal with this, I just say just write it all down. And if in the final version there's something that you just feel you cannot live with it being out there, then take it out. But include it at least for the time being, because that might be, if it's that painful and that much something that you're trying to avoid, it's probably pivotal in your life, and you might need it in the book. And you also will be surprised, at least in my experience, how smart people are and how good they are. That has been the big shock for me, is, you know, I was completely braced to have people throwing tomatoes at me. And it's the reaction has just been so beautiful, and it has really changed the world for me, the way I see the world. Because I've come to realize that I was walking through life with a suit of armor on, ready for battle. I didn't need the damn armor, and you know, it's a lot. You're more vulnerable without the armor, but you can also sure breathe a lot easier.
Yeah. Well, we have so much more to talk about, so all of you out there, stay with us. We will be right back after a real quick break, so don't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We've gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Hasper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett still, and want to tell you that we are also podcasting and have 107 or so shows up now that you can get to if you go to penonfire.com, which is my website, and click on the radio tower there on the left side of the screen. And at the top of the radio page, you will see directions for how to reach the podcast. This show will be up perhaps next week so that you can direct your friends to the podcast to listen to it, people who've missed it. And I also want to say that Jeanette Walls, who's my guest today, will be at the ASJA conference the third weekend of April in New York City at the Grand Hyatt. She's our keynote speaker. And if you want to know more about that conference and about that afternoon when Jeanette is keynoting, please go to asja.org. That's the homepage for the American Society of Journalists and Authors. And from that page, you will see links to the conference page. Let's bring Jeanette back. Hi there.
Hi.
You know, I wanted to ask you, and I think this is something that probably new writers of memoirs go through, and that is, and you touched on it earlier, but how much do you tell, and do you allow people in your family or people that you're writing about, do you allow them to vet the manuscript, to read it, to approve or disapprove, and then what? And then what do you do with their reaction?
Yeah, that's just such a tough thing because, you know, it's one thing to make the decision to reveal your own secrets, but you have to, in doing so, you have to expose the people around you. You know, you can change people's names, but you can't, even if you change your sibling's name, anybody who knows them knows that they're in the same family. So that was a tough decision, and something I really grappled with, particularly when it comes to the story of my youngest sister, who had some real problems. And I kept on putting in stuff about her story and taking it out. I just couldn't decide how much of her story to include.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a number of reasons. First of all, I've been out of touch for 10 years with my kid sister, so I couldn't get her approval to do this stuff. And I couldn't just pretend I didn't have a third sibling. You know, so her story is also part of my story, and it's a very difficult decision to make about how much of her story. And I decided I ended up taking out most of it, largely at the advice of my editor, who just said that's her story. And I was getting off track by trying to tell her story
mm-hmm.
as well as mine. You know, but there's also the difficulty in discussing my parents. Now, my father's dead, so that wasn't an issue. And I don't think I could have written the book when he was alive. My mother was very nervous about her reaction. She knew I was writing the book. She didn't ask to vet it. If she had it might have been problematic. I didn't want to show it to her because there's a scene in there where we kids are all hungry, and my mother has a little chocolate bar hidden away. Actually, it was a quite big chocolate bar, but I can't tell you the number of people who've said, you know, I think it's a very damning scene, and I can't tell you the number of people who've said, you know, your mother had me until the chocolate scene. Like, you know, she's like, that she lost me on that one. But oddly, that scene doesn't bother her at all.
Mm-hmm.
She was furious about my description of her driving, but that's that's okay. You know, we've had a lot of really interesting conversations about the book since it's come out, and it's been quite fascinating to me to see readers' reactions to my mom, because some people, the majority of people, are actually quite tough on her. They think that she should have never been allowed to have had children, and that she was criminally negligent. A smaller percent, but it's been interesting to me. A number of people say, you know, your mother is a unique American character and lived life the way she saw fit and mothered as best she could and gave you many wonderful gifts. And I really tried to leave it up to the reader what they thought. And I think that for anybody out there grappling with this issue, my advice is just to be fair and compassionate and to try to understand that person's motives. Nobody sees himself or herself as a villain. And if you can try to understand where that person is coming from and not blame those people. I mean, a lot of readers have been upset that I don't blame my mother more, think I'm in denial about it. But I think, you know, there's a very interesting article in the current issue of Vanity Fair where they discuss this whole issue. With the whole Augustine Burroughs lawsuit, and the author was quoting somebody who said that memoirists are obligated to show people in their families their books. And, you know, it really is on a case-by-case basis. You just can't make any blanket statements. I mean, you know, if somebody was truly had a horrific existence and had a terrible, terrible parent, do they owe that person the right to vet their life story? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
But legally, you know, there are certain constraints as well. I mean, you have to be careful. My book was vetted by a lawyer. Some of the names were changed by the lawyer at the lawyer's insistence. But to my surprise, nobody that I wrote about was upset with mm-hmm. what I wrote about them. Like I said, you know, my mother and I have had some interesting conversations about the things that I wrote about her. But I think it's just important to try to, this is my perspective, though other memoirists would really disagree with me, but I think it's important, and I've said this at some talks and some people get a little upset with me, but I think it's important to understand it and accept the people in your lives. Now, that doesn't mean approve of. There's a big difference, but I personally feel that memoirists should understand the motives of all the people and shouldn't, it's so easy to villainize other people, but in villainizing other people, you're victimizing yourself. And, you know, so that's just my philosophy in life. But I think people should be very, very careful about blaming other people for their, for their sad situations. Now, there are certain people in this world who are truly bad, but and do you owe them kind treatment in your book? Of course, never kind, and I believe never whitewashed. And that's the challenge for the writer, is to get across the good and the bad. You know, my parents, who some people, like I said, some people see that they're really had a lot of faults, but they also had good qualities. And I think that that makes for more interesting reading, and I think that's the way life is, you know, that you try to understand people.
Well, it was interesting, you know, what all the things that happened in your family, and yet there really seemed to be a certain love between all of you, and definitely you for your father and you for your mother, and they for you. And I found that really interesting that you know, as well as in the voice of the book, you, the narrator, you, the author, there wasn't sort of editorializing. You just sort of stated what happened.
Well, you know, again, I tried to, since I wrote it as from the perspective of a child, I don't believe that a child really passes judgment on their parents. But I really did want to leave it up to the reader. And I think it makes it for a more interesting read that way. That was my feeling, that, you know, that's the way life is. I mean, some people look at a president and see a hero, and some people see a villain. You know, we can all look at the same person and look at the same list of accomplishments or whatever you want to call it, and some people see it as good and some people see it as bad. So I really wanted, you're absolutely right, I did not pass editorial judgment in the book. I wanted to leave that up to the reader. You know, some people have said that I look at it in a sort of, with sort of rose-colored glasses. That's my general outlook on life. And there is no bitterness towards my parents. I mean, the thing is, I'm keenly aware that neither one of my parents is perfect. I mean, I'm not in denial about the extent of their quirks or whatever you want to call it. But I do believe that they gave me a lot. And, you know, it's been very interesting for me to talk to readers, because the number of people who've come up and said, oh, my gosh, my life was so similar to yours. And some of them loved their parents, and some of them hated their parents. And, you know, even within my family, there's a story that I retell in my book, and it's my very favorite childhood memory. It's when I was 5 years old, and we had no money for Christmas presents. And my father took each of his children out into the desert night, and for our Christmas present, let us choose whatever star we wanted from the sky. And like I said, it's my very favorite childhood memory. And when I was recounting that story to my older sister, Lori, who's always been much smarter than me and saw right through my father's BS, she said, isn't that like that sorry son of a bitch dad of ours to give away something that doesn't belong to him in the first place? And the thing is, she's right. It was an empty gesture, but I'm also right. It was, you know, a precious gift. It is whatever you choose to make of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope that the readers take away from the book whatever they choose to make of it. A woman came up to me and said that her book club had had a heated debate over that particular scene, and she wanted to be able to report back to them, was it a wonderful gift, or was it just your father's drunken shenanigans? And the answer is all of the above.
Right.
Because, you know, life is what you make of it. And so that was, again, that was one of the challenges in trying to write the book, is to leave it open-ended, which I believe life is. And so I was trying to reflect the open-endedness of life, that, you know, you really can't pass judgment. Now, I know that some readers would like for me to have said, you know, my mother was good or my mother wasn't good or whatever. You know, as I said, I believe that she had many gifts, and I'm not bitter because I've got a great life. I've got this wonderful, you know, husband. I've got a good job. I'm very happy, so why complain and be bitter about where I am or where I had, what I had to go through to get here.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has surprised me is the number of people who've come up to me, very often people from very well-to-do families, saying that they were actually jealous of me when they read the book. And for those of your listeners who haven't read the book, I went through some pretty wicked stuff when I was growing up. We didn't have food. I had to dig around in garbage cans for food. We were always running away from the law. But they envied my freedom, and they envied the fact that my parents really did not pass judgment on us and did not criticize us, and that I could do whatever it is I wanted to do. And there's a lot to be said for that. Now, you know, you could look down on this as neglect, or you could praise it as freedom.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, some of the things you guys went through, you just go, as a reader, I'm thinking, now how is she going to get out of this and be healthy, you know, have a healthy life?
Horrific. But as a child, they didn't seem horrific. I mean, when you're a little kid, and one of my father's great talents was being able to persuade us children that it was an adventure, and or that other kids, because they weren't as bright and strong as us, couldn't have put up with this sort of stuff. And for a really long time, I completely bought into all of that. And he did make life seem like an adventure. Then by the time I was getting, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old, I started realizing this isn't so much fun, and other people have nice houses and we don't. And so, you know, part of the writing challenge was writing about that transformation and that realization without sort of coming out and saying, you know, from the grown-up perspective, by this time I realized, you know, so as I said, I had a brilliant editor, and she would flag whenever I lapsed out, and sort of she was very shrewd about understanding what it was that I was trying to do. And in an early version, she took out what I thought that were some of my most clever lines, and her reasoning was, this is too processed.
Mm-hmm.
She felt that that wasn't the way that a 7 or 8 year old child would think.
Mm-hmm.
So she was very keen-eyed, and I really have to give her credit for that.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I have some minutes left with Jeanette Walls, author of The Glass Castle, published by Scribner. I have to say, the most moving part of the book for me was in part the beginning of part 5, when your sister, your father has died, and your sister and mother are coming to visit you and John.
Aren't you sweet? Well, thank you so much. Yeah, you know, the book, I do believe in happy endings. I'm a very optimistic person, and you know, even though my father died, and everything. I believe everything turned out okay. Not perfect. My kid sister still has issues and still is dealing with those things. But, you know, I did inherit my mother's sense of optimism. One time when life was pretty nasty and I was sort of giving her grief for not working things out, she said, you know, oh, Jeanette, you worry too much. Things usually work out in the end. And I said, and what if they don't, Mom? And she said, that just means it's not the end yet. So, I did think that everything, you know, despite what we didn't have when I was growing up, we went hungry, we didn't have indoor plumbing, we didn't have heat, but I do believe that my parents gave me a sense of optimism. And the reason I called the book The Glass Castle was because my father, he always promises he was going to build us this great big house out in the desert that was entirely solar heated, and he never did build a house. So you could look at it as an empty promise, or you could look at it as I chose to, which was hope for the future. I really did believe for a long time he was going to build us that castle, and that's what got me through the tough times. And even though he didn't build it, I mean, I could be angry that it was yet another one of my father's lies, but I believe that it was that hope that got us through the tough times. And I believe that that's something that my mother and father both gave us, was a sense of optimism for the future and a belief that things would work out in the end. And I think that's not such a bad legacy.
Mm. Yeah. Talk about optimism. Your mother has got to be one of the most optimistic people ever.
Some people would say to a fault. Some people would say that she's in denial, but, you know, she would deny that. but she's, I think she's a hoot. You know, as I said, some people get very angry with her and think that that she should have never been a mom. You know, and you could certainly argue that. She did not have overwhelming maternal instincts, but she loved life and still does, and very creative. And I have to tell you something else, that this was actually pointed out to me by a reader, and I must say readers are very, very smart. But a reader said, you know, she never put your kids down. She never criticized you guys. And I just think that that's incredibly significant. There's also there's another scene in which, you know, my mother, she had some assets that she didn't cash in on. And again, I just think that readers are so smart. And I went to a reading one time, and there was a bunch of people who read the book in their readers group, and they erupted in this great big argument about whether or not Mom should have sold the land. And to most people, that would be a no-brainer that she should have sold it. But one of the women was arguing, you know, if she would have sold it, that drunken father of hers, which had just got his hands on the money, the drunken husband mm-hmm. of hers, would have got her his hands on the money, and it would have been gone. So I really have to give give readers credit. It's very funny. And what we were discussing earlier about my fear about readers' reactions, mm-hmm. they have actually understood some things about my life that I didn't. They've had astonishing insights. And the great gift that they've given me in exchange for coming clean about my life is that they've made me feel less isolated, made me understand, oh, my gosh, everybody has something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've told me stories about their lives. And, you know, sometimes these are people who had hard scrabble backgrounds, much like mine, and sometimes they're people who are very well-to-do. And it has awakened me to the fact that obviously I knew on some level beforehand, but I don't think I understood the degree to which, gosh, you know, we all have these things in our past that we think might make us different or a little bit weird, and that they're not a source of shame. And sometimes I'll go out to a signing or something and somebody will start crying and tell me this thing about her past, and he or she, it's actually happened with men as well, they're very nervous and telling me this. I can't believe I've never told anybody this before, but I'm telling you, I think you'll understand. And then they'll tell me something about their past, and I think, why on earth would you be embarrassed by that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a really great story, and it makes you, suddenly I see the person differently. They've just been a stranger, and all of a sudden it's somebody who I like and respect and think is a very interesting person, and I realize, oh, yeah, I felt that way, too, before I came clean with my secret.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's been fascinating for me.
I want to ask you about, this is sort of a side note, but it has to do with your book. And, you know, I read the book, and the other half I listened to on CD.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I had a really different reaction because the reader, and I wondered what you thought of the reader if you'd listened to your book on CD, because your voice, your speaking voice is very different from, of course, the reader who read your book on CD. But I found that I was able to read and draw my own conclusions more when I was reading the book rather than when I was listening to it. Because,
oh, that's really interesting.
Because she had a certain attitude, that I felt that the reader of the book was interpreting your book and not liking the mother and, you know, really, really bringing herself to it.
I will confess to you, I listened to about a sentence of it on CD, and I turned it off. It was too weird for me.
Mm-hmm.
It did not feel like my voice.
Yeah.
I'm not going to criticize because everybody reads it differently, but that's absolutely fascinating to me that you had that take on it. That's very, very interesting. And,
Yeah, it's interesting because I think readers of books can either, you know, give you a really good experience or give you a not so good experience. And I was really happy that I'd read the first half of the book, you know, on the page instead of listening to it.
This is just fascinating. But it actually makes sense because that is the way that a lot of people would read it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I haven't listened, so I can't really pass judgment on how she did it. But it was very jarring to hear somebody else's voice saying it. It's like, oh my gosh, that's not how I sound. That's not how I feel.
Right.
I just had to turn it off. It was just a very strange experience. I also, honestly, I have trouble looking at my written words as well. Though it's a strange thing. You look at it and you think, oh my gosh, that's really a little bit clunky. So I don't like listening to my own stuff. So I thought that maybe was what I was reacting to. But I think I was also reacting to what you mentioned as well.
Yeah, well, your speaking voice is so different from hers. And also, as you're saying, the intention of your words on the page, I think, were different than what she brought to it. But, you know, it's been a bestseller for a really long time. So I don't think her reading of your book has affected the sales, because it certainly is doing so well. And you must just be amazed.
I am. You could knock me over with a feather. I am so shocked. I honestly, I had no idea. I'm still in this in a slight state of shock over it. I'm beyond gratified. But it's funny. Somebody asked me if the whole experience has made me big-headed. And it's funny. It's almost to the contrary. It's been a very humbling experience. it really, as I said earlier, you know, because I did not expect people to be as smart and good and giving as they are. And it's just really made me rethink everything and made me realize how damn stupid I've been about, mm-hmm. about people, about how badly I underestimated people's compassion and their intelligence and their goodness. And it's just really made me rethink the world.
Hmm. Well, gee, we're at the end of our time, and I wonder if in keeping with the tradition of this show, if you have any words of wisdom or advice for the listeners who are perhaps working on a memoir, working on a piece of writing that's difficult to get on the page.
Absolutely. And I'm just going to crib for my mom and say, just tell the truth.
Yeah.
Just tell the truth. And don't be afraid of it. Don't be afraid of it. You know, there's a scene in my book where my father, where I think I hear a monster under the bed, and I half expected Dad to say, there's no such thing as monsters, but instead he said, was it that old demon? And he went hunting for the demon and couldn't find it, and Dad said, you know, the thing about old demon is he's a chicken shit coward. And like most cowards, all you got to do is just stare him down, and he turns tail and runs. And it's taken me this long to understand what he was really saying, which was face your fears. And for me, my fear was myself. It was the truth. And Dad was right. You stare that old demon in the eye, it really can't hurt you. And if you're really, really lucky like I've been, you can put a harness on your demon and put it to work for you. And in facing the truth, you will understand things about yourself that you didn't know that you knew, and you will own it. And it is a very emancipating experience.
Mm. Well, thank you. And thank you so much for writing this book and for coming on the show. And we'll see you in New York in April.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
Thanks so much. That was Jeanette Walls, and her book is The Glass Castle, written by her, published by Scribner. What a moving book and bestseller on many lists. So check it out. Never talked about the cover, which I loved, and it's this black and white, wonderful, wonderful cover. Oh, so much else to talk about. I can't always talk about the covers of the books, but again, in April, third weekend of April, Jeanette will be the keynote speaker at the ASJA conference in New York City. Go to asja.org and read more about the conference and about Jeanette. What else can I tell you? I can tell you that this show will be podcast in the not-too-distant future, hopefully next week. Go to penonfire.com, click on the radio tower. You will arrive at my website at the radio page and directions for getting to the podcast for this show and for all shows. There are many up there, many wonderful shows up there at this very moment. I think that's it. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Ernest Hemingway again, who said in a letter to Charles Scribner, Jr. in 1952, he said, "After a book, I am emotionally exhausted. If you are not, you have not transferred the emotion completely to the reader. Anyway, that is the way it works with me." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I'll see you next week. Take care.